Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we hear from an author who retells one of the most sordid incidents in our state's history, the string of murders and mysterious violent deaths that marked the Osage Reign of Terror. After oil was struck in the Osage Nation back in the 1920s, the tribe became some of the richest people in America. With that wealth, they became targets of a major conspiracy to kill members of the tribe and take their oil money. While the official death toll was 24, the number of mysterious suicides, accidental poisonings, or one-car accident deaths means the unofficial toll ran much, much higher. After a great deal of bungling on the part of law enforcement, eventually some of the killers were brought to justice in the first big success for J. Edgar Hoover's Bureau of Investigation. The story of this conspiracy is told by New Yorker staff writer David Grann in his latest book, Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. Grant is also the author of The Lost City of Z, which was recently adapted into a new motion picture, which is opening this weekend. And he'll be visiting northeastern Oklahoma for several signings, including one here in Tulsa, Monday evening at 7 at the OSU Tulsa Auditorium, sponsored by Booksmart Tulsa. David Grant is my guest today. David Grann, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, I'm happy to be on the program.
Yeah, after years of tramping around the Osage, you've come out with this new book, Killers of the Flower Moon, about what is generally known as the Osage Reign of Terror, the murders in the 1920s of Osage Indians holding head rights or oil royalties. How did you come upon this case?
I heard about the story all the way back in 2011, an historian had mentioned it to me. And at the time, I was shocked when I looked it up to discover that I knew nothing about it. I did not know that the Osage had been the wealthiest people per capita in the world back in the early 20th century. I had not known that they had been mysteriously murdered, and I had not known that this had become one of the FBI's first major homicide cases. And so upon learning all this, I made a journey out to Osage territory back in 2012. And I describe in the book how I went to the museum and I saw this great panoramic photograph on the wall that showed members of the Osage Nation and white settlers. It was taken in 1924. It looked very innocent, but there was a portion of the photograph that was missing. And I asked the museum director, you know, what had happened to that missing panel. And she said it had contained a figure so frightening that she had decided to remove it. And she then pointed to the missing panel, and she said the devil was standing right there. And the book really grew out of trying to understand who that figure was and the history he embodied. And, of course, it was one of the ringleaders of many of the murders, that figure. And it led me to what I would gradually realize was one of the most sinister crimes in American history.
And that was William Hale?
That was William Hale.
Yeah.
She went down into the basement. This is Catherine Redcorn. She was then the museum director, and we've become friends since then. And she was incredibly helpful to me during my research over the years. And this was the first time I met her, though. And she went down into the basement, and she pulled that she had an image of the figure of the missing panel. And she brought it out, and there, peering very creepily from the corner, was William Hale, the King of the Osage. And in the book, on the title page, I show the whole panoramic photograph. You can actually see Hale peering out from the corner.
So how did you begin investigating this? Because, you know, you say you knew nothing about it, but, you know, for many Oklahomans, really, it was sort of a forgotten story. It's one of those things that the state sort of sweeps under the rug for a long time, except within the Indian populations. And then it sort of comes out 50, 60 years later after most of the people involved are long gone.
Yeah, well, I think that's a really important point you make about, you know, when I thought about that picture that was removed from the museum, the Osage had removed it because they could not forget what had happened. They're intimately familiar with this history, and I think it's really important to always stress that. But so many Americans, including myself, had no memory of it, no knowledge of it, or neglected it. And I thought that was really kind of shocking. And I began the process. It took me close to 5 years to research and write the book. It involved what we call in the business Freedom of Information Act FOIAs, where I would request every government institution I could think of that might have been involved in the case or might have records, and I would send them asking them to release their files. I spent a lot of time in archives. There's a branch of the National Archives in Fort Worth, and it looks like something out of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's like this enormous warehouse. It's like the biggest thing I've ever seen. And you can pull these documents. And in those records, I would spend many weeks out there I found things like the secret grand jury testimony from the cases, which, at least to my knowledge, had not been made public before. I found a whole bunch of other records that began to give a hint of the depths of the conspiracy. And then the final and in many ways the most important and moving element was tracking down descendants of both the murderers and the victims and interviewing them and getting their oral histories and getting any records they might have. Because one of the things I really wanted to do in reconstructing the story was both to get the Osage perspective and also to let the reader really know what this was like, to feel it, to experience it, so that it was not just an abstraction. Because if it's an abstraction, then people don't pay attention, and it's too easy to ignore. And so that was part of what made the process so long and arduous.
Now, your previous book, The Lost City of Z, started out as a New Yorker article. This didn't appear in The New Yorker, did it?
No, they did do an excerpt you know, before it came out,
right.
So the first chapter on the website. You know, and it was just too sprawling a story from its very inception. It really didn't fit as a magazine story. The canvas was too big and wide and really too sweeping. It really could only see it as a book. And I structured it in such a way, too. The book is told in three chronicles, and the first chronicle is told largely from the point of Molly Burkhart, an Osage woman who's really quite remarkable. In many ways, she straddles not only two centuries, but two civilizations. She was born in a lodge speaking Osage in the 1880s, and within a few decades, because of oil, she's living in a mansion. She has a white husband. She's speaking English. And she becomes the prime target of this, or one of the prime targets of this conspiracy, and her family. She watches as her sister Anna disappears one day and is then found a week later shot. Her mother dies of suspected poisoning. She has another sister who is so afraid she moves nearby into a house, and then one night about 3 a.m., Molly hears a loud explosion, and she goes to the window of her house, and she looks out, and in the direction of her sister's house, she can see a large fireball rising into the sky, and her sister's house had been blown up. Somebody had planted a bomb, killing her sister's husband, and a white maid who had lived in the house. And so the first chronicle is really told largely from her perspective, how what it's like to be in the center of this conspiracy, to not know who is betraying you, who you can trust. And she has, the story has a great deal of evil, but it also has a good deal of goodness. And she is a very good, quietly good person who has a remarkable courage in crusading for justice at great peril to her own life.
Now, if you're listening to this and you don't know the story, you would say, well, what is the point of killing off these Osage Indians? So I think we should take a step back and just discuss what had happened with the Osage tribe. Now, Osage had been, well, actually, they'd been all over the Midwest.
yes. They had once been in control much of the Midwest, all the way from, you know, Missouri and Arkansas, all the way to the edge of the Rockies. In the early 1800s, Thomas Jefferson referred to them as the Great Nation. He met with a delegation of Osage chiefs in 1804, and he assured them that they would be treated only as friends. And then within a few years, he was pushing them off their land. And within a few decades, they were forced to cede more than 100 acres of their ancestral land, and they were eventually bunched up on a reservation in Kansas. And by the 1860s, they were once more under siege. And it was at that point that a Osage chief stood up, and he said, we should go to this land, which was then in Indian territory, obviously later Oklahoma. He said, we should go there because the land is rocky and it's infertile, and the white man will finally leave us alone. And so they decided to purchase this land.
And that's the key right there. They purchased the land.
They got a deed, yes. So they had a deed to their own land. They migrated there. They were down to just a few thousand. And then, lo and behold, this forsaken territory turned out to be sitting upon some of the largest deposits of oil than in the United States.
And with it came untold wealth to the members of the nation. And they became millionaires, literally, within a year or two.
Yes. So each Osage, there was about 2,000 of them registered members on the tribal roll. They each were given what was called a headright. And essentially, a headright was a share in the mineral trust. And so if you had a headright, every time a prospector leased land for oil or had royalties, you got a percentage of that, and you began to receive a check. And 1923, just to give some sense of the amounts of money, the Osage collectively received what would be worth today more than $400 million. And they lived in mansions, terracotta mansions. They had servants, many of whom were white, which made very many white Americans disconcerted, because it belied these longstanding stereotypes that whites had of Native Americans. It was said at the time, whereas one American might own a car, each Osage owned 11 of them.
Yeah, and with this wealth came jealousy, And you make this wonderful point in Killers of the Flower Moon. You said, you know, you portray, you know, William Skelly, Frank Phillips, all these names that we know here in Oklahoma, E.W. Marlin. And he said, nobody bats an eye when they build a Philbrook or the Marlin Mansion in Ponca City. But the very idea of an Osage Indian spending extravagantly prompted this sort of paternalistic attitude that they had to be protected from their money.
Yeah, it's really, I mean, you have to realize this is the 1920s. This is the area of Great Gatsby, of prolificacy. And somehow the Osage are scapegoated because they have money. Many of them spent their money responsibly. Some didn't. They were just like every other person. And yet people were felt somehow that the Osage, because they were Native Americans, couldn't handle their money. I mean, here was Marlin, who made a fortune, then went bankrupt, and he bought a bigger mansion, then went bankrupt. And members of Congress would literally sit in hearings. I mean, you read the testimony, you just can't believe it. So they would sit in these hearing rooms discussing the Osage wealth as if, you know, the nation's security was at stake. And, of course, they appointed these white guardians to oversee their money to many of the Osage. And this was a deeply racist system. It was quite literally based on the quantum of Osage blood. So if you were a full-blooded Osage, you were invariably deemed, quote-unquote, incompetent and given a white guardian. And so behind this, you know, veil of enlightenment really was this hammer of coercion, which so many Native Americans had experienced throughout their history. And what's more, this system wasn't only racist. It literally led to one of the most greatest state-sanctioned systems of a criminal enterprise, because many guardians would abscond with money and steal and get kickbacks. And they would literally, when people were running for election, one of the ways they would get elected was promising guardianships to certain people. It's like a form of patronage.
Yeah, and this guardianship was literally holding the purse strings for the person with the head right.
Oh, yeah, you could be an Osage chief who led a great nation, and you could have millions in your trust, and they were telling you, you know, whether you could get toothpaste at the corner store.
Oh, my gosh. And this set the stage for these murders.
Yes, and it goes back to the head rights, which is so important, because one of the things that the Osage had done back in during the allotment in 1906 before Oklahoma became a state was, in their treaty, when they inserted in their treaty for allotment that they would maintain the subsurface mineral rights, which is very shrewd on their part. So much of the surface territory disappeared, but they maintained control of all that subsurface. It became really the first underground reservation. And a head right could not be bought or sold like the way surface land could be. The only way it could be passed on is through inheritance. And so that is what led to these incredibly sinister, calculating, conspiratorial plots that would play out over years with people pretending to love and insinuate themselves, white people, men and women, insinuating themselves in the family, so they're murdering off members of the family so they could inherit the head rights.
There would be a guardian. If there were no progeny to inherit that on, it would go to the guardian eventually.
It could go to the guardian, and if you married in, you could just make it go to yourself. So you would, if you were the husband and you killed your wife, you became the heir to that, to the head right. I mean, even saying it is so abhorrent, but that is essentially how it worked. And there were plots even to kill children. I mean, this was, you know, greed and prejudice fueled to create really one of the most sinister crimes, certainly in my career as a reporter, you know, going back 30 years that I've ever worked on.
My guest today is David Grant, a staff writer for The New Yorker and author of Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI, his new book published by Doubleday. His last book, The Lost City of Z, is going to be a motion picture coming out, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. The death toll officially was 24, but give us, for example, you mentioned Molly Burkhart. She lost her sister. She lost various members of her family. How many of them were considered actual murders?
Yeah, so really only two were officially designated as murders because they couldn't be covered up. I mean, the bombing in the house, obviously, and then her sister was shot in the back of the head. One of the killers was upset that she was shot in the back of the head, that they couldn't make it look more like a suicide or something like that. Only two of those murders were officially designated. The mother's suspected poisoning was never, you know, officially, although later it would often be included. She lost another sister who died under mysterious circumstances, and we don't know to this day what caused it. And that was not officially included in the murder toll. And one of the things you begin to discover, and I should stress, it wasn't just Molly's family. I mean, other Osage were being systematically targeted at the same time. There was an Osage champion steer roper who got a call one night. He heads outside, comes back into the house. He drops dead, frothing at the mouth. Evidence later suggests that he was given strychnine, which is an awful, awful poison. I mean, it's often in Agatha Christie mysteries because it's just an anguishing form of death. Your body essentially convulses as if with electricity, and you're conscious while you slowly suffocate. And one of the reasons poisoning was so common, and one of the main reasons of killing the Osage, and gets back to your question, how many were officially included, poison was an easy way, because law enforcement was often corrupt, incompetent, or not fully trained, they wouldn't do toxicology. So you could often slip somebody a poison and not have a death included in the official toll. And there were more than two dozen murders included in the official FBI toll. But anybody who has looked into this case, any Osage, scholars, other writers, myself, you begin to realize that there were scores of murders, and most of those remained unsolved and were never included in the official tally.
Yeah, mysterious suicides, one car crashes.
Yeah.
You know, you were talking about the poisoning as a favored method. This was also the time of Prohibition, so there was, you know, moonshine that wasn't made properly.
Exactly. You could poison the moonshine easily. Yep.
So you mentioned Molly Burkhart is one of the three figures you focus on, and she really is an amazing character. She really fights at her risk of her life.
Yes.
Who are the other two that you mentioned?
Yeah, so then the second person is Tom White, and he tells the second chronicle. He is also, like Molly, in many ways kind of straddling two centuries, and in many ways this book is about the formation of a modern country and all these cross currents, including the clash of civilization between whites and Native Americans. Tom White was born in right around the time of Molly in a log cabin on a frontier in Texas. He came from essentially a tribal community of lawmen at a time when justice was often meted out by the barrel of a gun. He was a Texas Ranger and then joins the Bureau in 1916. And by the time of the Osage murders, when he gets summoned by the new bossman, J. Edgar Hoover, to Washington to take over the case, he is wearing a suit and a fedora, and he is struggling to adopt modern techniques like fingerprinting and handwriting analysis, which becomes an important part of the case, and he has to file all this paperwork. So he's in this process of kind of professionalization. And he gets summoned to Washington after the Bureau had badly bungled the case. For 2 years, they had made no arrests, and at one point, they had gotten this outlaw, a guy named Blackie Thompson, who was once very well known in Oklahoma. I may not remember now, but was one of the big outlaws of the age, and they had decided they wanted to use him as an informant, and they took him out of jail, and instead he slipped away, robbed a bank, and then killed the police officer. So suddenly state officials were up in arms. Hoover feared a scandal. He had just taken over the Bureau. He was 29. It's hard to believe he was insecure in his power, but he was. And he essentially brought in Tom White to help salvage the case and protect his own job, his own skin, Hoover's own skin. And White was a very experienced frontier lawman, and like Molly, has a quiet goodness about him. And he puts together an undercover team. And among them, which I found very interesting, was a Native American, probably the only American Indian agent in the Bureau. They didn't keep statistics, but I don't think Hoover would have had too many, given his prejudices. So they go in undercover, they pose as cattlemen, one sells insurance policies, and they begin, with the help of the Osage, to try to unravel this mystery.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned William Hale at the beginning as, you know, the devil. In the first murders, he's usually the first man on the scene. He was so trusted by the Osage.
Yeah, he was seen as this great benefactor, almost a populist in a way. I mean, he showed up in the Osage at the turn of the century with nothing on his back, carrying little more than a Bible, and within a span began to buy up territory, became the most powerful cattle baron in the region and rancher. And he was known as a true friend to the Osage, as he would say in his letters. He was considered very close to Molly and her family. He was a pallbearer at some of the funerals of the victims, including at one of Molly's sisters. He professed to help Molly Burkhart with the investigation, issuing rewards and hiring private detectives. Meanwhile, he is at the center of the conspiracy and hiring the private eye simply to cover up his own deeds.
One of the things I really enjoyed about this book was some of the sort of little facts that you throw out. For example, you set the scene at one of the lease auctions, And, you know, for all of these names that we know as sort of like founding fathers of the state, you know, the philanthropist Frank Phillips or William Skelly, you give us a very different picture of these guys as they're making their fortune. You describe one lease auction where literally Frank Phillips and William Skelly get into a fist fight.
Yes, they're on the floor like cats.
while the auction is going on.
Yes, yes. And I think it was Harry Sinclair who made off with the lease very triumphantly. Yes, I mean, what's interesting in this book is so many elements of the formation of Oklahoma, but the formation of the country is happening. So the same with the FBI and the Bureau and Hoover, and the same with many of these oilmen. Many of them first made their fortune in the Osage, including the Getty family. I mean, J.P. Getty, I found an interview that he gave. You know, he first went to the Osage as a little boy with his father. He describes riding across onto the reservation. They had a little lot 50 where they struck oil, and that's where they first got their money. And the leases were such in demand in Osage County that these auctions were held, and people like Skelly and Frank Phillips and the Gettys and Marlin and all these other prospectors would gather in Osage territory. Many of them would arrive on what was known as the Millionaire Special, which was a private railroad car, at least the wealthier oil barons. And then they would gather under this big elm tree, which became known as the Million Dollar Elm because the leases would sell for so much. And they would bid, you know, wildly and compete with each other. They had spies to scout out better land and where to purchase their leases, and they would gamble. This was a wild oil rush and oil boom, and these towns were wild at the time.
Yes, yeah. You go through this long investigation. This was really hard to unravel.
For the FBI?
Yeah, right.
Yes, I mean, it was hard to unravel because of the complicity of so many people in society. I think that's really important to understand. So one of the great challenges was not just identifying Hale. Probably the bigger challenge, because certainly many whites were aware of what he was doing, the bigger challenge was, could you even bring someone like that to justice? Could you find 12 white jurors, and they were men at the time, would have been 12 white male jurors in these trials, to convict a fellow powerful white rancher for killing a Native American? And it was an open question asked by the Osage at the time. And that was one of the great challenges that Tom White and his men found. And it was less in many ways like a criminal case at times than an espionage case. There were double agents, there were triple agents, there were moles, their reports were being leaked. You didn't know who was working with you, who was trying to betray you. And it was very easy to corrupt the justice system back then. There were so many people in power. If you were powerful, you could buy off officials, you could tilt the scales of justice. And that is what made the case so difficult.
This was the time of Teapot Dome in Washington, and, it went everywhere in the states as well.
Yes. The oil corruption went all the way to the Justice Department, to within the Bureau, where they just had the scandal with Teapot Dome. And so this sense of lawlessness, we forget just how lawless and how fragile our legal institutions were less than a century ago.
And, of course, you bring up a really interesting point of when something like this happens, the tendency is that, okay, well, these few bad apples were caught. But really, what your book points out is that there were a lot of people who were, if not completely complicit, they were aware of what was going on.
Yes. I mean, I think we tend to think of a crime where there is a kind of a singular, and this is how the Bureau kind of conceived of the crime or the way they envisioned it, was a kind of a singular evil force in the embodiment of William Hale. And that when you remove that, society returns to normal. And what is so disconcerting and what is harder to recognize or to come to terms with that in a case like this, there was not just a singular evil force. That evil lurked in the hearts of many seemingly ordinary people. That there were other murders within families, a single person who may have been killed for their head right. There were morticians who covered up the crimes. There were politicians who either were getting kickbacks or covering up the crimes or directly profiting who participated. There were lawmen who were bought off. There were bankers. There were guardians. Guardians were often the most prominent people. This was a culture of complicity, and it's much more disconcerting and difficult to come to terms because it kind of unravels our whole notion of kind of the way we often construct crime stories.
And once again, we mentioned the official death toll of 24 during the Reign of Terror, but another writer, Dennis McAuliffe, wrote that, and you quote this in the book, over the 16-year period from 1907 to 1923, 605 Osage died. That's a death rate of about 19 per thousand. The national death rate was about 8.5 per thousand. Is it safe to assume that at least maybe half of that doubling of the rate was perhaps the result of foul play?
Well, what that number just shows you is that something was just deeply out of whack, that there is no easy explanation for why there was such a higher death rate. And what you have to understand is Osage back then had a lot of money. They had the best medicine, so there's no reason why they should be having a higher death rate. At one point in that warehouse I described in the archives, I had pulled a document that listed guardians and the Osage, who they were in charge of their money. And I began to notice, when I looked at it, there might be a guardian who had five Osage, and you would see the word dead written, scribbled next to each one. And you don't always know. Some of those deaths may have been from natural causes, but it defies, just as Denny pointed out, Denny McAuliffe, it defies any natural death rate. And you begin to realize you're seeing hints of a systematic murder campaign. And then, the same way Denny, who looked into the murder in his family, and you look into the suspicious deaths in other family, you begin to find evidence of murders. And so you begin to realize that this conspiracy was much broader and deeper than was generally presumed at the time. Now, the Osage obviously sensed it, but in terms of the authorities.
What was the reaction when you began asking questions in Osage County about this? Was it were the people welcome to talk about it, or was it sort of a subject that they didn't want to revisit?
I'm always careful to, you know, not wanting to speak for others and you know, exactly how they felt, because I didn't always specifically ask them, but my sense is that this is still deeply living history. In other words, we're talking, I spoke to some second-generation people who actually knew Molly, but in most cases it's third generation. I interviewed Molly Burkhardt's granddaughter, Margie Burkhardt, and, you know, she talked about growing up without cousins and aunts, and she took me to many of the murder sites, and you begin to get a sense of the legacy and the reverberations and the ravaging of these crimes decades later. They were overall incredibly generous and helpful to me. I really could never have told this story without their help. And again, I'd have to ask them, but my sense was that I think they realized it's a secondary crime that this story is not known to everybody else. This was part of our history. And so while the Osage deeply know about it, so many Americans don't, including myself when I began. And so they really, I think, had that sense of hopefully trying to document this history, to record it. And in some cases, there were suspicious deaths in families, and they would give me trails of evidence to look into, to hopefully bring some resolution. And in some cases, I got circumstantial evidence. But one of the great tragedies of this case is that because there were so many conspirators, you know, lots of trails of evidence have dried up. You can't always interrogate the witnesses. You can't interrogate the suspects at this point. And I'd always thought of history as kind of bringing in accounting when there was an injustice. You could identify all the killers and you could identify the perpetrators. But one of the things I realized in this case is that you can't do that in many of the cases. And history is not just the horror of what you know. It's often the horror of what you don't know.
Thank you for bringing the story back to light. That's important.
Thank you.
David Grant, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for bringing attention to the story. I really appreciate it.
David Grant is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and the author of Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI. It's published by Doubleday. He'll have several signings throughout northeastern Oklahoma this weekend, starting Saturday at 10 a.m. at the Waterbird Gallery in Bahuska, Sunday at the Tall Chief Theater in Fairfax at 2 p.m., and Monday evening at 7 at OSU Tulsa Auditorium in a author talk sponsored by Booksmart Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.